Monster Man, episode 457, Sturge to Sue Monster. Hello and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the gaming books of yesteryear. And as I do, I'm talking about the monsters that I find in them. Their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games. In today's episode, we're taking a look at two classic monsters that first appeared in the 1977 Monster Manual, and seeing how they have been updated in the 1993 Monsters Manual for AD&D's 2nd Edition. But before we do that, it's time to thank some new Patreon backers. Yes, these are people who've gone to patreon.com/monsterman, and they have pledged as little as $1 a month to help support the show. And if, like today's backers, you pledge at the $2 or higher level, you'll also get access to my other podcast, Patron Deities, in which we take a look at the myths and religions of the world and how to find inspiration from them for use in RPGs. We're currently doing a series on Tengrism. So thank you very much to Ben Moole, David McNamara, and Mike Monikowski. I'm glad that you're enjoying the show, and your support means a lot to me. Let's start today's episode with the Sturge. You know, the Sturge is probably the definitive, like, low-level flying D&D monster, which mainly just goes to show that it's not a very deep bench, largely because it's hard to have a weak antagonist that can fly. Even a not very powerful monster becomes a lot more of a challenge when it has such a huge mobility advantage over an adventuring party. Sturges are also notable for having like a lot of highly specific features, like their kind of weird design with a long proboscis and whatever. They kind of look like giant mosquitoes, but sort of with bat wings. It's all a bit weird. So they have this very specific design that's not reflected in any kind of detail of their background or description. So exactly what they are is not really made clear in the Monster Manual. I mean, they're kind of bat-skeetos, I guess. I guess that's the pitch. This entry expands on the Monster Manual one, and I quite like some of the ideas that it adds. The main sort of conceit here is to treat Sturges like a pest. They're a swarming colony creature, and they will, like, move into an area, start feeding, and then once they've exhausted the food supply in a relatively small radius, then they'll move again. And that makes them quite hard to wipe out because they don't stay in one place for very long, but they can be very dangerous because they target, mechanically, they target the weakest foes, which means that they tend to go after, like real predators, the sick and the weak. So if you're an adventuring party, you might think of Sturges as a nuisance, but if you're a village, you've got like children and elderly people that can't really protect themselves against Sturges, and that's a real threat. So this is nice because there's no reason that like a predatory animal would go around fighting a bunch of armored knights and rangers and things if they could go prey on somebody else. And so that shifts it from having to protect yourself from a bunch of Sturges who've been quietly nesting in some chamber that you booted a stuck door down and crashed into, and make it more like, oh, your job is to protect other people from the Sturges, which I think is a more interesting fight. See previous episodes about crafting interesting monster fights. It does maybe run the risk of reducing the PCs to the level of pest control, but I think it works in this situation. There's also a description of special armor that's used to prevent Sturges from being able to smell you, which is kind of like a beekeeper suit, which I think is funny. Now, I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, James, you're always complaining about the mundanification of fantasy creatures. Why is it okay to give this kind of naturalistic context to the Sturge, but not okay to give it to, like, a manticore? And I think for me the answer is that the Sturge never really had much of a context, right? It was one of those D&D creatures that existed solely to live in a dungeon and be a trap. And I think what's happening in Monster's Manual is that the people who are writing it have kind of decided that any context that's not naturalistic has to be either discarded or supplemented. So it's not okay for, I don't know, a Lamia to have a mythological origin. It has to have a fantasy ecological context. And I think that that is a less interesting substitution, but I think that's different when you look at a creature like a Sturge, whose only real context is gamey. It's there because there needed to be a dungeon hazard. And so to give it some kind of spurious ecological context where we have like observable animal behavior that we can learn about and so on and so forth, we can decide that they hunt by smell, we can set up Sturge nets, etc., that gives it something that it didn't have before, rather than taking away something that it did have before and replacing it with something else. I don't know. That's not a model I've tested. I'm not saying I put my weight on it, but that's kind of how I feel about these monsters. Sturges kind of already, insofar as they had anything, had that sort of naturalistic character, but without any detail or any hooks that went with it, right? They didn't have much about them that was unique. All right, next up we have the Sioux Monster. Now, whereas the Sturge had a Tony DiTerlizzi illustration, it's always weird to me that Sturges are brightly colored. I know that that's in the Monster Manual. Monster Manual, of course, always talking about the color of things because it is partly a painting guide. The Sioux Monster here, again, we get, you know, an okay colorful illustration, but it does rather unfortunately, like, I get what it's trying to show with the head of the Sioux Monster, is trying to give it like a monkey-like ridged skull, or ape-like, I guess I should say. You know how like a gorilla's head kind of has that crest shape to it? I get that that's what they're trying to do, but it just sort of makes it look like it has a flat top, which makes me imagine the Sioux Monster as like a judgmental post-World War II sort of gym teacher. It should have a little whistle around its neck. So unfortunately, I don't think it quite works. It's also one of those things where the historical Sioux like just looks weird, whereas this one just a bit too obviously looks like a monkey. And we've seen that, I don't know off the top of my head which artist this is, we've seen that with this artist before, where they have a little bit of a tendency to read descriptions of something as being like a fish or whatever, and then they just draw a fish. Wait a minute, James, the historical Sioux? Yeah, so we've talked about this back in season one, but just to reiterate, the Sioux Monster is a creature from kind of like Renaissance, early modern, writing about the New World. So it's not like a mythical creature. It's more like a cryptid, I guess, or not even a cryptid, because I don't think people thought its existence was a secret. It's just a European writer writing about a creature that is said to live in South America. And this probably comes into D&D via Edward Topsell's The History of Four-Footed Beasts, which is the same source that gives us the Gorgon as a big, stink-breathing bull creature with metal scales, rather than Gorgon like Medusa. Right? It gives us the Gorgon as a kind of Cataleptus. That may come directly from History of Four-Footed Beasts, or it may come from a derived source, I'm not sure. One thing that can be easy to forget about having this kind of 21st century perspective is that we are very spoiled when it comes to knowledge of monsters and the weird and whatever. When I was doing research for a folklore bestiary, you know, and I wanted to know more about the Gumbaroo, it was trivially easy for me to find copies of Fearsome Creatures of the Lumberwoods and to learn about the history of the book and to read up stuff about the kind of like hunting culture of the 19th century, etc., etc. Not that I'm saying a lot of that information went into the book, but like it could have. And we sometimes forget that the people who were creating these creatures just didn't have access to that stuff in the 70s, and it was much more hit and miss. You know, if it so happened that the Lake Geneva, Wisconsin Public Library had a copy of the Time Life Book of Monsters that cribbed from Topsell's History of Four-Footed Beasts, then that's going into Dungeons and Dragons. Or if it so happens that, you know, someone happened to find a cheap medieval bestiary in a used bookstore, there are parts of what we take for granted. We look at cryptids or we look at folkloric creatures as things about which much is known. That is very easy for us to get our hands on information about these creatures. You can see this with the way people write about Selkies. Like, when I was a kid, I'm sure I was the only person in my school who had heard of a Selkie. And I heard it through Scottish heritage. You know, I heard it through my mother, who's Scottish, listening to Scottish folk music. You know, you couldn't just type Selkie into Google in those days. So anyway, I guess what I'm saying is that some of the weirder monster legacies in D&D are a product of that kind of chance, you know, and of a drive for multiplicity. So it suits Gygax to have a Gorgon be a poison-breathing metal bull because he can call a Gorgon a Medusa and then have this other thing being a Gorgon, and that gives him two kinds of monsters, right? He doesn't want to pick. He wants to include everything. So whatever comes across his plate is going to wind up in the game one way or another because he constantly has to find new and interesting monsters for his players. And he isn't being, like the modern day internet person, constantly flooded with information about creatures and having to be selective about which he includes. Anyway, other than that, the Sioux Monster is fine. Its most interesting gimmick, I think, is the way in which it goes into like a defensive frenzy if its young are threatened. But you have to engineer that a bit because I think it's very unlikely to come up in a typical game, particularly in a typical 21st century game, right? I don't think there are many D&D games out there now where player characters are going around like stealing the young of Sioux monsters to sell them on like the exotic animal market. I'm not saying people don't play bad guys, although I think people play bad guys much less than the classic game would like to think, but very few people play petty, contemptible bad guys for very long, because the game simultaneously seems to be interested in encouraging and punishing that behavior, and also because people like to feel cool and special. So there's probably not that many low-level dirtbag games, although I'm not saying they can't be fun. Anyway, my point is, you're gonna need to, like, have the guy who was carrying the blue jewel get eaten by Sioux monsters so that the jewel is in their den, and then when you go in there to get it, the mama Sioux monster thinks you're threatening the babies. Or you could just do like a fun random encounter where like the baby Sioux monster comes out and everybody's like, oh, it's a little monkey. Hey, little buddy, you want some bananas? You know, player characters, my players anyway, they love like a fun wildlife encounter. And then the mama comes in and thinks you're threatening the babies, right? Because it's an accessible monster motivation. It's very easy to see, uh-oh, she thinks the young are being threatened. You know, that's something we've all been warned about with bears or what have you. Come to that, there's a similar encounter in Lorne's Song of the Bachelor with a tapir. So I think you can make this work, but I do think it needs a little extra kind of scaffolding to make it not just like an entry on the jungle random encounter table that is better to just avoid. All right, that is about all the monsters that we have time for today. In our next episode, we are taking a listener-requested look at mechanical creatures. How do we make these technological terrors work in a fantasy game? Is a sufficiently advanced technology really indistinguishable from magic? Find out in the next episode of Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. Thank you for listening.
If you have a favorite monster or something you'd like me to talk about, you can reach me on Twitter at GonzoHistory or by email, gonzohistory@gmail.com. To support Monster Man, just go to patreon.com/monsterman. Thank you to Ray Otis for designing the thumbnail image. Our introductory music is Solve the Damn Mystery by Jesse Spillane from the album Descent of the Goober Monster, used under a Creative Commons Attribution License. Thank you again for listening, and please join us next time.